Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You're tuned in to Real College Podcast, and I'm your host, Nathan Fervoy. We at Real College Podcast are tasked with providing you, our passionate listeners, with the best of what's going on in Twin Cities arts and culture. We are committed to scrounging through art showings and community events, concert plays, or wherever else interesting culture might pop up, serving as your eyes and ears to what's good around the Twin Cities. Today we're bringing you a collection of cultural happenings from around town, from May Day celebrations to Minneapolis arts in the digital realm. We'll start underground somewhere in the Como neighborhood, an appropriate place to begin, as it frequently serves as a beginning for many up-and-coming Minneapolis acts. Como basements can provide young artists with a fun environment to establish their work, that is, if the damn cops don't show up. Here's producer Lizzie Ritchie with the inside scoop.
I am angry and disappointed with the police for shutting the show down because it is in Como. The Como neighborhood is like the hub of house shows in Minneapolis.
There was one band left, man. Like, one. And they're really good and deserve to play, so.
We all know what Como kids dread most when throwing a house show. The cops showing up and shutting it all down because of a noise complaint. On Minnesota Music Day, Midway Access, a local house venue in Como, decided to throw a small show in celebration. The energy was high and everyone was really excited to dance and hear some great tunes.
You know, the energy is really good. Like, I get to come and I get to dance and I get to look cute, but also, like, I can get sweaty and, like, mosh around and everybody thinks it's great, you know?
The headbanging, the kissing, the drinking, all of that, super good.
Well, tonight I'm excited to just kind of, like, see the music and play the music. That's mostly what I'm into. But I'm also excited to meet some people, hang out with some people I already know, and just kick it in general, you know?
I'm excited to mosh to the other bands before we go on and then fall asleep afterwards. It's going to be great.
Yeah, it's Record Store Day and Minnesota Music Day, so I'm here enjoying Minnesota music.
It's obvious that all these folks would be so excited to see a bunch of cool bands play. Some were here to see their friends play, and some even just wanted to make some new friends and enjoy the music while they're at it. House shows in Minneapolis tend to be really positive atmospheres that draw a great community of people who all share their love for music. I walked around for a bit and asked some friendly faces what they were doing there and what they like about house shows. Maddie from local punk band Loneliest Ways and Oliver from Lapdogs had some words on what they prefer about house shows.
I think you get to be much more intimate. Like, I get to jump down into my friends and, like, scream in their faces.
But I think house shows are the best because you can just do whatever and, like, everyone's having a great time and they're there to be there and it's, like, free and it's fun, you know?
House shows build a really close-knit community, and I think that's why the most common answer I got was to see my friends play some music.
Okay. My name is Brittany, and I am here to see my friend's band.
And I'm here to see my friends play some music.
I'm here to kiss boys.
And?
I'm here to hang out with my friends and have a good time and hear good music.
My name is Des, and I'm here to see Lapdogs and some other good local jams.
I'm here for the music, because I love all the bands that played tonight.
Right as the night started picking up, the cops showed up and started shutting everything down. People were obviously upset because we weren't doing anything wrong, but a noise complaint was enough to stop the fun.
The police came and they shut down the show. And it's a real bummer because we're just trying to have fun and build community and play some beautiful music and share some wonderful art with each other. And they just had to shut it down because they're pigs.
How do you guys feel about the house show getting shut down tonight?
It sucks.
Yikes.
Sucks.
Okay.
I'm upset. My friends didn't get to play. That's like the primary reason I came. It was fun though. I still had a good time.
I'm pissed because so much more crime happens at frat houses, but they pay off the police.
A lot of students here at the U feel that there are worse crimes going on at campus and that the police should be putting their efforts elsewhere. Frat houses are notoriously known for never getting busted, but it is quite common for house shows to get shut down. I talked with one of the folks who lived in the house about how they felt.
How do you feel about having the house show shut down tonight?
I mean, like, this is like the 9th cop call, so it's just getting kind of old.
I mean, 9th time tonight or ever?
No, like, times the shows had to get cut because of cops.
9 times Midway Access has been busted. That's crazy. Some say it's because of the police routes through the neighborhoods, and some say it's just the neighbors calling in. Hopefully, in the future, RCP can look a bit further into why house shows get busted so frequently in comparison to others.
The May Day celebration is one of Minneapolis's most unique cultural features, and a favorite for many residents, new and old. This year's event was as colorful and strange as ever, but rumors of it being the last May Day celebration ever added a slight air of concern and anxiety. Ben Hallam has more.
For the past 45 years, the Heart of the Beast May Day Parade has exploded onto the streets of South Minneapolis in a festival of joy, puppetry, and community engagement. But this year's May Day Parade, about a month ago, may have been the last. A few months earlier, Heart of the Beast announced that it would be unable to fund the May Day Parade on its own, a $200,000 venture which almost always loses money. Attempts at crowdfunding have come up short of their stated goals. While the state of the May Day Parade is still up in the air, one thing is for certain. While the Heart of the Beast may lack the funding to put the parade on, the community that grew up around the parade remains as dedicated as ever. To find out more about this community, I visited one of the pre-parade float construction sessions at the Heart of the Beast Theater earlier this April. One of the first things I noticed when walking into the Heart of the Beast construction space was the noise. The whole theater space had been converted into a place to build puppets and floats for the upcoming parade. The sound of conversation, discussions, and strategies for the construction of the puppets, and the sound of tearing paper, which would go into the papier-mâché construction of the parade floats, filled the room. I started by speaking to the stage manager, Suzanne Cross, about the general plans for the parade.
With the ceremony this year, we're doing a lot of about the wounded and brokenness of our climate overall when it comes to humanity and needs and how we are supporting each other, since our theme overall is beloved community. You can't talk about how, we don't want to just talk about the utopia of, or the perfect utopia of what this our beloved community is. Yes, there's beauty and magic in it, but there's also a lot of heartache, and there's a lot of people who are going hungry, and there's a lot of things that are happening that we can't ignore. Through that, we're also giving back, since it's the 45th May Day, and also a May Day where the future is kind of up in the air. We are planting, Sandy wanted to plant a tree. We thought we would plant 45 trees, and then she decided, no, let's do one tree for the first year, 2 trees for the second year, 3 trees for the third year, equaling 1,035 trees we're trying to plant to change the canopy of South Minneapolis. So we really need help making sure that all these trees get into the ground and find homes, because we want to say thank you to the trees for all the cardboard and all the paper that we've used over the years.
As Suzanne said, even though the future of May Day remains up in the air, they make sure it will endure through the trees that they're planting throughout South Minneapolis. But they've also made sure it will endure through the community that they've created. Countless people's lives have been impacted by May Day and the opportunity for creative expression in community with others that it represents. I spoke to several people who shared their experiences with me when I was at the workshop, and I'm bringing you two today.
Sure. I'm working on a couple of different sections. I'm going to be in working a large puppet in one of the sections, a large cat puppet. And since the artist is making this large puppet, I've been just helping with the whole section, paper macheing, bananas, and large picnic forks and other assorted sundries. And I'm here with my daughter, Sappa, who's working on a fox mask, and she's going to start painting. And I've been doing the May Day Parade for, golly, I guess about 10 years or so in various forms. I love this part of it probably the best, the workshop section, where you can come and just work. I really can't think of a better way of community building. I am a non-religious person, and this is what I think of as art church. So I feel like it has a lot of good effect on people working together on a common goal and purpose that is definitively not boring and is both expressive and creative and is really for, it's, it feels like one of the few things that we engage in that's really by and for the people of my neighborhood. So that's why I like it.
I'm working on a dog puppet inspired by my own dog for the get-together section. Well, I've been coming to the parade probably, I think, all but 2 out of the 45 years, and I've been working on making the parade for about 25 years. So I've been involved for a really long time, and I'm not a staff member or anything, but I've been, just a very involved volunteer for a lot of years. The community aspect of it, that it's every time I look at this workshop and realize that the community is what makes this art project, this giant art project, and that we all make it together, that's what keeps me coming back. It's very unique for a huge, you know, art project like a parade and ceremony to be made by a huge group of community members together. So it's very unique. And that's what keeps me coming back every year. I'm trying to hold back the sadness about, like, what if it doesn't keep going on and everything. So there's a sad aspect to, you know, how I feel about things this year, but I'm trying not to be, because I really do believe we will keep having the parade. It's been such a huge part of my life.
As you just heard, the volunteers I met at the May Day workshop were dedicated to the parade and the community that had grown up around it. And most of them believed that the parade would carry on, in some form, into future years. And being in the workshop and seeing all the construction going on around me, all the people who had dedicated so much of their time to this parade, it was hard to disagree. For Real College Podcast, I'm Ben Hallam.
From Minneapolis arts displayed openly on the street, let's shift perspective to a very different format for local artists to display their work. Instagram. The art scene in the digital realm can be a great platform for local artists to get their work out to people around the world. But as local poet Hannah Dove found, amongst thousands of other artists, it can become a bit overwhelming.
Oftentimes, the medium is the message. Movies are made for the silver screen, while bingeable shows are placed on Netflix for easy access into the creative wormhole. But what are we to make of poets young and old who have jumped from the physical written text to the worldwide web of writers? People's concept of what poetry is already an amalgam of wildly different experiences. Some might have stopped reading poetry in the 7th grade when they were using Cliff Notes to determine what Keats was really going on about. Some might understand social media poetry through the lens of famous Instagram poets like Rupi Kaur, praised for her poetry's accessibility, but scorned for the lack of supposed depth in her work. Is there a difference between publishing poetry online versus in print, besides the fact that almost anyone can do it? Does the gratification that comes with likes and shares online somehow deteriorate the message behind the work? For the month of April, I participated in a month-long poetry challenge called Escape Roll, in which I needed to post a poem based on prompts if I desired, every single day. Along the way, I discovered a large community of Instagram poets, with some who had followed the challenge's creator Savannah Brown from the very beginning, and others who had already amassed a huge Instagram presence to go off of. But I had no idea what I was in for when I created my first poem and posted it online for the world to see. But first, let's step back a bit. We need to set up exactly what Escape Roll, a portmanteau of Escape in April, is, and the quote-unquote rules behind it. The concept of Escape Roll was first created by 22-year-old YouTuber-turned-novelist Savannah Brown. The event centered around mostly poetry, but prose and flash fiction were also welcomed. You had to post your final product on Instagram and then hashtag it with Escape Roll or Escape Roll 2019, inviting the participants to wonder whether or not this would be an annual occurrence. The posts you made could take any format, from screenshotting a poem from your notes app to filming yourself doing slam poetry or making animations to go along with your words. To maintain some form of cohesion, a prompt was designated for each day, with vague descriptions such as body as friend or foe, and femininity that were meant to get the creative juice juices flowing. A reminder was set out every day, but it was mostly up to you to get your own poem done by the end of the day. This was the first time that Miss Brown had done anything on this scale, so there were certainly a couple bumps in the beginning. For instance, many people complained that the prompt reminders didn't work for them, considering that they were in an entirely different time zone than the author herself. Not only were there several thousands of people participating, over 12,000 by the end of the month, but these were people from around the world coming together to make poetry. Savannah herself chose a less hands-on approach, proclaiming herself as the friendly ghost of escape role, there to answer questions if asked. However, no matter how hands-off you try to be, I quickly realized how much Instagram feeds off the concept of celebrity. If you had your piece reposted by the Let's Escape Role page, that meant that Savannah herself enjoyed your piece. Followers would come flooding in, hundreds at a time, and oftentimes abandoning ship if they realized that you weren't going to do a follow for follow as some demanded. Names winked out of existence in the blink of an eye. That's not to say that everyone was a bounty hunter when it came to seeking approval, but a like from the friendly ghost of escape role often elevated people to demigod status, and it was no small feat. People would create sympathetic posts telling others not to feel disappointed if Savannah didn't share their poems, while those who did get shared often described themselves as feeling overwhelmed at the newfound size of their audience. With every interaction out on display, people were much more wary about who liked what and who posted what. This was actually my first time being very active on Instagram, whereas before I mainly flipped through people's stories when bored. Now I was put at the front reel, and it felt pretty surreal. I was seeing others with more likes and comments, and that left kind of a bitter taste in my mouth. I'd never been prone to jealousy, though I think everyone says that. But by poem number 12, I found myself desiring to be like the cool kids, which is the plot of every coming-of-age story ever. I had started out by making my poems with new designs each time to see what would stick. I took an hour to make a stop-motion video for one and designed a cool background for another, but I never seemed to get more than 10 likes. I think it hit me this hard because this was an entirely new experience, and it was hard to focus on your personal growth when every minute you got updates from thousands of other writers. But I was not alone in feeling this downtrodden. Accounts had started making PSAs about how you shouldn't worry about other people's likes and comments, how Escape Role was meant to be about focusing on yourself, and how they were there if you needed someone to bounce ideas off of. This was new for everyone, and no one likes feeling alone. Online or offline. That's when I started to look elsewhere for advice, and what I found changed my perspective. Tons of websites claimed that they had the tips and the know-how that would launch you into Instagram stardom, but it all kind of coalesced into the same sort of format. It wasn't just about individual posts, it was about your feed or your Instagram account as a whole. Did you have a coherent aesthetic, color scheme, and font choice? Did you use a similar art style each time? Did you use the correct amount of hashtags? Did I post at the same time every day, or do I know the time for peak interactions per day? My words didn't seem to speak for themselves anymore, my brand did. My brand took time from my real life and placed it neatly in the boxes of each of my posts. My brand as an Instagram poet gave me authority over how others perceived my work, who saw it, and who liked it. Never before had I seen a perfect example of micro-celebrity, or cultivating an internet persona in action, and something about it felt off. I'd like to believe that the creative sphere is a meritocracy, and in some respects that is true. I'm not claiming to be the world's greatest poet, not even close. I just didn't understand the mechanisms behind this form of singular brand creation before, especially with something as subjective as making poetry. This is not to say that my experience was completely negative. I set out to challenge myself in making a poem every day for a month, and I managed to do so with only a couple mistakes for a day or so, and then I corrected myself. Not only that, but I got to witness a community explode from the ground up. Suddenly, it wasn't the admiration of Savannah herself that others craved, but the admirations of those they admired from the community. I even had a couple of fans leave sweet remarks on my own poems, which didn't do anything but help my self-esteem about my own writing. I also found myself checking my account every day, and for a challenge in which you need to be held accountable in a daily schedule, Instagram's wildly addictive algorithm supplied a perfect basis. People seemed to be writing from the heart, too. Within their posts lay text-heavy descriptions of where they got their inspiration, and nestled amongst their stories were get-to-know-me questions that spanned everything from favorite color to their writing idols. Savannah herself only published 10 or so poems before quitting, but I saw people posting 2-3 times a day. And when the month of April finally ended, this large-scale community didn't fall into a vacuum. People started their own challenges for May and onwards into June, or told others that they were taking a break to work on other creative endeavors. I ended up learning a lot more about myself and my fears and desires than I expected, which made me feel all the more brave for posting things that I actually felt proud of. In total, I feel that writing challenges help bring a community together, but the addition of the unwritten social media rules adds another darker dimension to innocent posts that ends up cultivating a personal brand whether you like it or not. So don't be afraid to jump into the pool, but tread lightly. This is just Instagram poetry, right?
As you might notice from walking around the cities this summer, the Twin Cities community offers a wide array of lifestyles and living situations. Families, refugees, and young professionals all call the cities home. For some, living alongside others in a co-managed community, or co-op, is the lifestyle of choice. Producer Ben Hallam paid one such group a visit to find out how the co-op lifestyle functions and how it fits the philosophies of the house members.
How often, in your everyday life, do you make an attempt to totally transform your way of being, your way of living? I, for one, don't do it very often. And I'm all right with that. But for this episode of Real College Podcast, I talked to some people who weren't, to some people who are trying to constantly transform their way of being in the world. I talked to Nick, Gibby, and Nan, members of the Students Co-op, a cooperative living organization on the University of Minnesota campus, about their efforts to transform their way of life and the world around them.
My name is Nick Knighton. I use he and they pronouns. I'm a third-year student at the University of Minnesota, and I've lived at the co-op for what feels like 2 lifetimes, but it's been just over 2.5 years. So we actually, as 29 tenants, are equal parts member owners of this building. So we don't have a landlord. We don't sign any lease agreements. We do month-by-month due payments, and it's very much kind of an informal, facilitated by the house process of how we run. And so I think what makes this unique is that the individuals who live here also do all of the maintenance, do all of the finances. We do a lot of community kind of organizing. We just held a workshop upstairs. Part of our mission is to heal systems of oppression. And I think that intentionality is what I really love about the co-op, is that most of the folks that work here really are here to put the work in and to really do a kind of transformative healing of ourselves and our community.
That word, intentionality, was something that came up during my discussions with Gibby and Nan as well. It's a word with its roots in the scholastic philosophy of St. Thomas Aquinas, but was brought into modern discussion by Franz Brentano, a German philosopher and psychologist, in his 1874 book, Psychology from an Empirical Standpoint. For Brentano, intentionality was the simple idea that every mental phenomenon was directed towards an object. That means every thought had the characteristic of being about something. However, the term intentionality in modern usage has come to mean something very different, something that relates far less to the thought of Franz Brentano than to that of one of his more famous interlocutors, Martin Heidegger. For Heidegger, intentionality means something more than just your thought being about an object. A thought isn't just about an object, he claims, it's about what you do with an object. This idea of intentionality, which includes an idea of purpose or meaning or goals when we perceive objects, is one of the ways Heidegger believes human freedom is made possible. It's this idea that because human thoughts are always not just about objects, but about purposes and uses of objects, We're capable of choosing other paths in life other than the one into which we have been thrown by being born in a particular place, in a particular culture, in a particular class, in a world that was created outside of our own control. It's this Heideggerian idea of intentionality as the capacity to choose a new path in life that I saw in the people I talked to in the co-op, and their belief that they were creating a new way of being together. A belief Gibby and Nan express more thoroughly here.
Living here provides you with a sort of support system you don't get other places. Here, I know everybody's names. I know something about them. I know their major. I know what room they sleep in, and like, it's a lot more intentional, right? Like, we have a deeper relationship with each other than we would if we were just living in an apartment complex or something like that. Because there is an intention of, like, you applied here to be part of a community.
Not just that. I feel like when I applied here, I came here to be part of not just any community, but a community that seeks justice internally and externally. Like, I feel like a big part of being here is having access to, like, a lot of different avenues to do social work. It's given me the opportunity to, like, stay cued in to what's going on in the greater community around me. And it's given me, like, this, like, feeling that, like, I can speak and I'm not just nobody. Like, I'm not just Nan who lives wherever. I'm Nan and I'm from the students' co-op and I'm a member owner. And, like, living here is part of my commitment to greater justice movements in the Twin Cities, because living here is not easy. Like, there's so much labor that, like, I do, that my housemates do, to keep this place running and keep it from crumbling, both, like, physically and, emotionally.
According to Gibby, a lot of that emotional work might come up in co-op meetings.
We might even vote to just intentionally change and steer our culture in a different direction. And so part of the work is showing up to those meetings, because they can go very long and they can be pretty intense. But, like, we've been having a lot of conversations recently about how white the space is and how, like, masculine the space is. Like, we'll talk about that in house meetings. And we recently had, like, a 5-hour-long house meeting, so, like, 7 p.m. to midnight. We're all there talking about it, and it can get pretty intense like that.
As Gibby described it, this intensity increased as the co-op's project of living intentionally shifted from an exterior focus on resisting what they perceived as the flaws of the society around them to an interior one, addressing issues of inequity within the co-op. In some ways, this increased intensity can be seen as a move from Brentano's idea of intentionality and towards Heidegger's, from conversations which, in Brentano's sense, treated race as something to think about, conversations which Gibby described as
a little bit abstract, it was a little bit more like theoretical and stuff.
Quickly moved towards conversations in which, in a Heideggerian sense, race was something co-op members had to do something about.
Then we turn the lens inward and we're like, okay, but in our house though, like, let's talk about how whiteness shows up in our house. And that was, you know, it's mostly white people here, so it was pretty awkward for a long time to talk about it, but
these conversations took co-op members to another level of transformation, not just changing where they live or how they buy their food or how they pay their rent, but transforming themselves, changing who they were, their very way of being.
And I think a lot of the work that has been happening in the co-op is, like Gibby was saying, very abstract, and we weren't taking the time to really stop and ask ourselves, well, how is our everyday system representing the values in which we espouse to be so representative of the co-op? You know, we're recently, like, been overhauling a lot of the ways that we do things, because we realize that if we as individuals and as a community are not showing up for each other that way, how are we going to show up for the world that way? And so that's a really hard, internal, challenging question to be like, every decision I make has to be rooted in this framework. Like, every decision I make has to be representative of those values. And that's a very exhausting and challenging thing, because, you know, our socialized identities are, you know, they have to be broken down, and that's really emotional.
I think this last statement by Nick about how every decision becomes important when you're dealing with a socialized identity really captures what interests me about the students' co-op. As I said at the beginning, I'm not necessarily interested in embarking on a grand project of changing my way of life like the people who live at the co-op. But I'm very interested in whether it's possible, because I believe, following Heidegger and other existentialists like him, that that possibility, the possibility of transforming yourself and your way of life to transcend your own social conditions, is the very possibility of human freedom. As far as I'm concerned, the jury's still out on whether anyone can really, truly make this a reality. But it's always interesting to watch people try. For Real College Podcast, I'm Ben Hallam.
And that's all for this episode of RCP. Until next time, loyal listener. Real College Podcast is a production of Radio K. It's produced by Ben Hallam, Liv Riggins, Livy Ritchie, and Tosin Fasima. I'm Nathan Fervoy, your host and managing editor. All episodes of Real College Podcast can be found online at radiok.org or on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You can follow us on Instagram for a look behind the scenes. Thanks for listening.